Welcome to The Week Ahead in Russia, a Radio Free Europe podcast on developments in Russia, its war against Ukraine, and its relations with the rest of the world. I'm Steve Gutterman, editor for Russia, Ukraine, and Belarus in the Central Newsroom at RFERL, and author of The Week in Russia newsletter. This week's podcast is about Russia's war against Ukraine, as it too often is, and there's certainly no lack of developments that could affect the way things go in the coming weeks and months. And my guest today on The Week Ahead in Russia is Olga Oelker, the Program Director for Europe and Central Asia at the Crisis Group. Thanks very much for joining me, Dr. Oelker.
Thank you for having me.
It's great to have you on the show again. Thanks for being here. Let's kind of take stock of what has happened in the past couple weeks and where the war may be headed now. I guess I'm talking mainly about four things. Reports that the Biden administration has given Kyiv the green light to use longer range missiles against targets inside Russia, as opposed to Russian targets inside Russian occupied parts of Ukraine. And in fact, the White House has confirmed that this permission has been given, although it's a bit unclear. The scope, I think, of the permission is a little bit unclear, remains a little bit unclear. And also the apparent use of ATACMS missiles against such targets, as opposed to targets in Russian-occupied territory in Ukraine. And on the Russian side, I forgot to mention also the permission for use of mines. And on the Russian side, Putin's signing of a document that, at least on paper, lowers the threshold for Moscow to use nuclear weapons against an adversary. And then last Thursday, Russia's use of what Putin said was a new intermediate-range ballistic missile, which he called the Oreshnik, one that can be nuclear-armed, but in this case was not. That was used in an attack on Dnipro, Ukraine, apparently targeting, or at least Putin said it targeted, the Yuzhmash industrial facility. So my question is this, I'll just point out that this comes also at a time when Russia is making what appear to be the kind of the fastest advances in the Donbass since early in the full-scale invasion in 2022. Now, so my question is, in the wake of these developments, there's a lot of talk about escalation. An AP headline described last week as, quote, the week that raised the stakes in the Ukraine war. And the story said the week had, quote, seen the most significant escalation in hostilities that Ukraine has witnessed since Russia's full-scale invasion in February 2022. Olga, I'd be interested in your thoughts. How big a deal are these recent developments? Has Russia's war on Ukraine really reached a new level?
So, yes, I think these are big developments. I would say that just the comparative to early in the war, yes, Russian advances are moving faster than they have since early in the war. That doesn't actually mean they're moving anywhere near as fast as they moved early in the war. They're moving very, very slowly and very, very painfully for Russia, but of course also for Ukraine. So I think it's really important to understand just what this is. It's really bloody warfare, which is killing and wounding a whole lot of people, both Russian and Ukrainian. In terms of the specific events, it's interesting, you know, the Biden team with giving permission to use the ATACMS to strike deeper into Russian territory, with sending landmines to Ukraine. I think I kind of wonder if the Biden team is making an assessment that Russia is waiting for Trump's inauguration and that they won't do too much in response to anything Ukraine or its backers might do short of, you know, actually entering the war on Ukraine's side. So they've got more room for maneuver. And I think that's probably not a crazy assessment. I mean, I don't think the Russians expect great things from Donald Trump, but they expect something. And they probably are in a bit of a wait and see mode, which limits the extent to which they're going to escalate. So, you know, what we saw, for instance, is after the U.S. announced the lifting of the limits and Ukraine's first strike deeper into Russia, Russia announces its new nuclear doctrine and says that's its response, which, I'm sorry, that was not its response. They were not holding the new text of the doctrine back to respond when Russia used Western-provided weapons to strike deep into Russia. I mean, maybe, but I doubt it. You know, this was an agreed doctrine. It was going to be their doctrine. They were going to publish it. And then you get the actual response soon after, which is this, what they call a test of this new weapon, which can reach Europe. Yes, nuclear capable, but Russia's used nuclear capable weapons in Ukraine before. It has a lot of dual capable platforms. But the point of using a weapon that can reach deep into Europe, into NATO and EU Europe, is to make a longer term threat to Ukraine's backers.
Okay, thanks for that. Yeah, I mean, interesting. In a way, if this Russian use of the of this missile is seen as an escalation, but I think some analysts have said it's kind of a response that's along the lines of it's kind of like what Russia's doing when it's unable or unwilling to kind of really to use nuclear weapons. Essentially, Russia's been making a lot of threats to potentially use nuclear weapons. It's sort of mentioned, Putin and others have mentioned nuclear weapons many times, and the release, or I guess of the or the adoption of the new nuclear doctrine, which Putin had mentioned, called for the changes, made clear that they were happening a few months ago. It was one of those instances of Russia kind of doing this nuclear saber rattling. But in the end, this attack really, you know, as you say, it's a warning to Europe, but it's not, at least as I see it, not much of an escalation, because it's doing something instead of really escalating. Would you agree with that, or is that a misguided view?
Look, I think the Russians are trying to escalate while demonstrating restraint, which is always, it's a tough thing to do, to show your adversaries that you're restrained while you're escalating, and to also show them that you're willing to escalate further when you're being restrained. And I don't think anyone expected them to use a nuclear weapon in response to a strike with a longer range Western-provided weapon into Russia. And certainly no one I talked to in Russia said that that was how Moscow was going to respond. But they needed to respond with something. And they also needed to back up the doctrine whose innovations, such as they are to say that Russia considers... Basically, to say that Russia considers Ukraine and NATO members backing Ukraine to be legitimate targets. Now, it hadn't said anything like that before, but I don't think anyone doubted that it thought that. I don't think it struck new fear in the heart of literally anybody. But I think, you know, it also, and I think this is more important, it lowered kind of the stated nuclear threshold from existential threats to critical threats to sovereignty and territorial integrity, which, you know, you can parse that as long as you can parse existential threats. It's a little bit clearer, but it's also, you know, a critical threat is a lower threshold than an existential threat. So it's trying to send a signal that it is willing to escalate under certain conditions, that those are still not met, but that they could be. And this is the point of using that specific weapon. And I think, I think a lot of thought went into the selection of the weapon, the decision that this was how they were going to use it. It's not a sign of helplessness. It's an effort. Oops, sorry. It's an effort to signal. The question is what happens next? And what we've seen happens next is that Ukraine continues to use these weapons, Western provided weapons, to strike into Russian territory.
Okay, thank you. I guess you mentioned the idea that Russia, Putin, may be kind of waiting, waiting for Trump to take office, and not and trying not to escalate too much, but at the same time, to kind of keep threats going. So another question is how these recent events could play into what Trump, who takes office on January 20th, has suggested will be a swift search for peace or for peace talks. In fact, during the campaign, he said repeatedly that he would be able to end the war long before he took office. That obviously hasn't happened, and he hasn't revealed. There have been some. He's made some statements. The vice president-elect, J.D. Vance, has made more specific statements about what a peace plan might look like, but Trump hasn't actually announced one. I think a lot of analysts believe he has not decided exactly what he would do. But so my question is, have these recent developments made some kind of a push for peace more or less likely, and more or less likely to succeed if it does, if such a push does take place?
So there's 2 months before, almost 2 months before Donald Trump takes office. So a lot can happen in 2 months. But I do think there's a perception that we might be entering or even in the end game of this extended chess metaphor. And the reason for that is less, I think, about Donald Trump than the limitations on the armies. And we can see the limitations and the difficulties of the Ukrainian army because it's a fairly open, fairly democratic society. So we know that they're having trouble with mobilization and training and getting capable people on the front lines, particularly when the fighting is this bloody. We know that the population of Ukraine is interested. Public opinion polls suggest more support for a settlement now than there has been up until now. Harder to tell what's going on in Russia, but we also, things like the use of North Korean troops don't exactly send a message of strength, though it's not clear how many of them and how important they are. And of course, they're only based in what is what everyone agrees is Russian territory, right? They're not based in the parts of Ukraine that Russia is fighting in. So the Trump bit of this is all of these statements that he can get a deal. If he wants a deal, he has to first convince the Russians that they want a deal that isn't just Ukraine's surrender. Because if anybody wants a deal to last, it has to involve some Russian concessions. Otherwise, you're setting this up for more fighting, more war, even more escalation risks later. So they first have to convince the Russians to come to the table willing to actually negotiate, and then they have to figure out how to get the Russians to negotiate. That's not land for peace. You're not giving the Russians any land that they don't already hold under any of these quote unquote land for peace formulations. And, the Russians' message all along is that they can keep the war going. So I don't, the land for peace formulation doesn't make sense. It does not, also does not make sense because the Russians don't want land. They want Ukraine as a vassal state, ideally. The question is, what can they settle for that would enable Ukraine to remain sovereign and deter future Russian attacks, which is what you need for a more stable peace? And this is the question. So two pieces, right? How do you get the Russians to be willing to talk and make concessions? And then how do you get those concessions? Ukraine doesn't have leverage over Russia. The US and Ukraine's other backers potentially do, but then you have to decide how you want to use that leverage. And we haven't seen anything that actually lays this out from the Trump team.
Okay, thanks very much for that as well, Dr. Olker. I guess a follow-up question, just because there's been a lot of talk, I mean, for a while, but in recent days as well, about the Russian gains, territorial gains, on the ground. As I mentioned, we mentioned the fastest pace, and you pointed out that, not as fast as early in the war, and still quite slow and with enormous casualties. I guess my follow-up question would be sort of, how dire is this, does the situation seem in terms of, many say Russia's trying to gain as much territory as it can before Trump takes office. And there's talk about potential offensive targeting Zaporizhia, the city. So I guess the question is sort of how dire is the situation? Is there a good chance that that it will kind of change pretty significantly even before in the next couple months before Trump takes office?
I mean, what you're basically asking is whether the Ukrainian lines will crumble.
Yes.
I don't think they will. It's not impossible. Again, the Russians are making gains, but at great cost to the Russians as well as to the Ukrainians. It is really, really hard for Ukraine. They do have a lot to fix to keep, if they have there to have any hope of sustaining this for a longer term, but they can keep it going for a while.
Okay, thanks very much. I appreciate all your insights, and we are going to wrap it up here. Thanks for joining me, Dr. Olker.
Thanks for having me.
All right, my pleasure. And once again, I've been speaking to Olga Olker, the Program Director for Europe and Central Asia at the Crisis Group. And my name is Steve Gutterman, editor for Russia, Ukraine, and Belarus in the Central Newsroom at RFERL. This has been The Week Ahead in Russia. Our theme music is "Не стреляй" or "Don't Shoot," a song from the early 1980s by Yuri Shevchuk and DDT. Please be sure to check out my newsletter, The Week in Russia, which covers the latest developments in Russian politics and society, as well as Moscow's invasion of Ukraine. Subscribe by visiting www.rferl.org.